Well, we figured the 4th of July weekend comes and goes way too quickly, right? It's a wonderful holiday, so we decided to prolong it a little bit here with the sounds, some sounds from last night's Mason fireworks at the Ingham County Fairgrounds. You may remember the, I think it's safe to call it a bacchanal from last 4th of July at Torch Lake. About 10,000 people showed up at the sandbar in the south end of Torch Lake, a little northeast of Traverse City. I guess, according to the Detroit News, calm returned to Torch Lake this 4th of July here after the massive party last year, following an outcry from residents in Kalkaska County. Judge George Mertz declared the party a nuisance after last year's event and banned it for 5 years. 10,000 people showed up last year. There's no 166 arrests last year and 62 medical calls. And there's no official count here as arrests or anything like that, but it was a good deal more subdued than last year. It's current state here on 90.5 WKAR. Welcome back to our program. The city of Lansing is working to develop a new ordinance to regulate medical marijuana dispensaries. By some estimates, Lansing has as many as 70 shops where cannabis is sold for medical use. Michigan voters approved medical marijuana in 2008, but since then, regulating the industry has proved challenging. My first guest wants to see more consistency in the marijuana industry. Chris Riesbeck is a chef by trade, but he's also a licensed medical marijuana caregiver who has a vision for what he hopes will be a national organization that will set the standards for marijuana regulation. Chris, welcome to Current State.
How's it going?
I take it you see a lack of standards, a lack of uniformity out there in marijuana dispensaries. Describe what you see out there.
Well, coming from the culinary industry, which is an industry of copious amounts of regulations and standards, I come into this industry, which is beautiful and free and open, but it's also scary because there is no standards, no regulations. There is no system for me to operate in. So through the past 6 months of me being in the cannabis industry, I have just had to learn myself because there's too much information out there being published or being even just approved on by a general consensus of the cannabis consumers. And there may be little to no fact behind it. And it's just, it was a journey coming to where I am now, but it is heartbreaking to see an industry that I love so much in shambles.
Give us some examples of some standards that need to be in place here to make commercially sold marijuana a safer, a more better regulated industry.
Standards need to be in place for any sort of interaction when it comes to cannabis, because an industry needs to be regulated from the top to the bottom. Anywhere from seed sales to clone sales, all the way to growing, to what type of nutrients, what type of pesticides. We need regulation for processes of concentrates, solutions. We need standards for edibles. We need standards for dispensaries. We need standards for how people need to exist in normal society with cannabis, because right now we're dealing with these current set of problems that is at hand, when who knows in a year or now what the new issues could be. It could be, well, medical cannabis patients want to go out in public now, and so how are you going to deal with that? So right now we're currently dealing with what issues are at hand.
But your organization here, the Guild of Connoisseurs, you're advocating for self-imposed standards. You're trying to appeal to the business owners themselves, correct?
What I'm trying to do is truly, a guild is an association of craftsmen or merchants formed for a mutual aid and protection for the furtherance of their professional interest. So that being said, with all the industry leaders out there who are kind of doing their own thing as they seem fit, that's a little scary to me, because there are so many good dispensaries, but then there are a lot of bad apples out there who really are scaring it, making it scary for people who, like me, who want the standards and regulations. We want the professionalism. We want the industry to be recognized as a positive, potentially even Yeah.
Advocates promote it as medicine. I mean, it would seem that it would be in keeping with the notion of marijuana as mm-hmm. medicine.
And especially with medical dispensaries being primarily dealing with medicine as their business, and there's a difference between operating a business, you know, making a profit, and greed. There is a huge amount of dispensaries owners who are gouging, paying dirt cheap for whatever they can get, and then selling it at such a higher rate when there's truly no standard of product. That's just an ounce of something being sold at a gram price for a profit.
What are reputable marijuana businesses doing, though? There must be, there's so much of this activity, there must be some kind of standards taking shape,
yes.
or kind of organically, forgive the pun.
Yes, the best dispensary owners know that educating their patients and educating anyone coming in is key to having a successful dispensary. Knowledge is everything in this industry. This is very trusting, honestly, with how amount of people are, oh, I'll try this solvent or this product based on what you said, when really they're going into it not knowing anything about how that product was made. So I think that the good dispensaries right now are not having any things on their shelves that they do not fully understand or know where it came from. They are start to finish. They know where it came from, who to get in contact if something isn't right, or if they need more of it, or how to fix it or tweak it, or there's just... they need to be involved to every level.
I think of the measurement, the labeling, everything that goes into the food industry.
Everything,
right?
Yeah.
I mean, it's an enormous, mm-hmm. but very important.
Being ServSafe certified, I know that there is just copious amounts. You go into a restaurant, you don't know the thousands of codes that are being upheld by the current restaurant.
My guest today, Chris Riesbeck. Chris is a chef by trade and a cannabis advocate. He's trying to organize a committee that would create a set of national standards, ambitious here, national standards to regulate medical marijuana dispensaries. He has a vision for what he calls the Guild of Connoisseurs. Very clever name. Talk to us about your vision for the Guild of Connoisseurs.
Well, my vision for the Guild of Connoisseurs is I see cannabis as a community, and on a national level in the future. This is nothing that's going to be happening anytime soon, or maybe it will. I would like to see it happen as fast as possible, but I'm going to take my time in pushing the development of the industry standards right now. But what we're doing is taking the people who know the business. It's not just me coming saying, hey, I'm from this business, I think this is what we should be doing. It's a collection of all the industry leaders. I have bylaws set up. There will be elected board positions, committees, the whole kit and caboodle on a fully operational scale.
What services would the Guild provide here?
Services of the Guild would provide anyone who wants to know about cannabis. It's basically an educational outreach. If you want I'm sorry, there's so many different branches to go down with this. Cannabis is such a diverse industry that you could go down any different branch talking about the services. They're going to offer all the services. If you have any sort of question or need of a cannabis-related service, we are going to be there to either A, guide you to teach you to do it yourself, or B, we will do the service for you. How I want this to set up on a national level would be similar to the AOA, which is the Osteopathic Association, or the Doctors
Association.
Association
of Osteopathic, AOA. Okay.
AOA.
Okay.
Yeah. Excuse me.
We'll take your word for it.
It is the National DO Committee. And what we're doing is we want to have a statewide, so we'll have the Guild of Michigan, the Guild of Indiana. And then from that, it will branch down into the local communities of, do we need a Guild of Lansing, a Guild of Jackson? How many? What's the population reaching out for? How many people are there? Do they need this guidance? This is, of course, way down in the future when the growing becomes a hobby rather than a medicinal plant.
How many Lansing area business owners have you talked with about this idea?
I have talked to 25, 30, multiple in Lansing and all outside of Lansing.
And how do they tend to respond? What's the most common response you get from somebody in this business?
Please. Yes, please. They are very excited to see an industry regulated organization coming forward rather than waiting for an ordinance or something to take place. That being said, I want to work with any government agency, because if we're going to be doing standards and regulations and you guys are doing standards and regulations, I don't want to have to do the same job twice to meet your standards.
When I first heard about this effort here, I kind of thought I couldn't help but flash on the good housekeeping seal of approval kind of mm-hmm. kind of thing. A certified marijuana business, you know, would there be that kind of certification?
Is that
what you've got in mind?
It's, to whatever level the community wants to accept it, my main goal with this is to have cannabis become a safely regulated and just a place of business, a good industry, an industry that should be regulated. Right now, it is being governed as an industry and then also as medicine. And that's causing a lot of unknown variables to rise up and a lot of problems.
Talk to us about cannatage, because I know this word has popped up several times here on your Facebook page.
Yes.
And on your website, and that seems to be a really important point here that you're trying to make. Talk to us about that.
A cannatage, like a vintage for wine, will be an archiving system of cannabis. The GOC will rate the product and record the total yield of the product in order to determine the official cannatage. This will give the supplier, especially the smaller suppliers, a certified quality product that they can negotiate a price based on both quality and available supply with the dispensary's owners. I personally have come up with a 25-point scaling system for dry herb. That is the only sort of standard I am bringing to the table right now. I am looking for other knowledgeable experts to help regulate products that I don't know. So what this will do with the cannatage is it's going to create an archiving system. So as we see a grower gain notoriety, it's with the education, you'll know where everything is being come from. So once you get a brand per se that you like, that brand value will increase. Now, specifically with a harvest harvest, there's going to be a set amount. So as the fame of that harvest goes up, the supply will go down. And in a perfect world, that should increase the value of whatever harvest is out there,
right,
which could create a whole different kind of marketplace for who knows what.
I'm curious about the states that legalized medical marijuana before Michigan. Are you seeing, there are a couple of states, Colorado comes to mind, mm-hmm. I guess. There are a couple of states that were at this before Michigan was. Have you started to see the kind of thing you're advocating here take shape in Colorado, California, other places?
There is a lot of, I would say, just positive business leaders out there right now with dispensaries or just industry leaders. They are in their own aspects promoting this positive image already. They don't know about the guild, but they are currently promoting a positive image of cannabis. And that's truly what this is about. This isn't about me trying to become famous. This isn't about me trying to make a bunch of money. This is about me seeing the vision that I have for this industry come to fruition with the help of everyone who is in this industry for the right reasons.
What do you need to happen now then, Chris, for this effort to really start to take off?
Well, the first priority of the guild is to not get the dispensaries shut down in Lansing. As of, for my own personal continuation of livelihood, I don't want to see the dispensaries shut down. I have had mothers talk to me saying that they're going to be turned into criminals if their caretaker doesn't have the supply to give for their child who has seizures. And that's just the only concern I have right now with this guild, is trying to figure out a way to keep the dispensaries in Lansing open, but also regulated to the finest amount, to the most accurate amount, and based off of fact, too, not of whatever numbers or standards may already be out there.
Are you against the idea of a medical marijuana ordinance for Lansing, then? Would the ordinance just have to be the right kind of ordinance?
It just has to be the right kind of ordinance.
You're not against an ordinance
per
se. No,
not at all. I personally think it needs to be an ordinance. There needs to be one today, even. I've personally dealt with so many bad apples in the dispensaries industry. Before working with this guild and starting this guild, I was a supplier of edibles. I was using my skills to try to help out local dispensaries, maybe start their own edibles. And it's just, there's so many bad apples that I hate to see them ruin this for everyone else.
You don't want to just put a numerical limit on the number of businesses.
That's silly. I don't think a numerical...
It's other kinds. What needs to be in the ordinance?
The ordinance needs to deal with specifically the issues, not a total cap. The issue is safety around schools, safety around playgrounds, safety around parks, not being next to churches. Anyone who has any issue with it, we need to tackle the true issues that are actually affecting the community and not just a bothersome smell, which is a little upsetting that someone's getting upset over a bad smell.
We're gonna leave it there. I want to thank our guest, Chris Riesbeck. Chris is a chef by trade, a cannabis advocate and caregiver. He's trying to organize a committee that would create a set of standards to regulate medical marijuana dispensaries. He has a vision for what he calls the Guild of Connoisseurs. Chris Riesbeck, nice to meet you, and good luck.
Thank you so much.
Coming up on Current State, around the country, many growers contend with too few bees to pollinate their crops. An MSU scholar has been working on ways to get both wild bees and human-managed honeybees to be more effective. More from entomology professor Rufus Isaacs on the way on Current State. The Michigan Shakespeare Festival is back for its annual six-week run, half in Jackson, half in Canton, Michigan. Current State Scott Pohl is here with more on the festival. Scott, the schedule's led by some of the most popular works by the Bard, right?
That's right, Mark. I got the lowdown from the Michigan Shakespeare Festival's producing artistic director, Janice Blixt. The first preview performance of this year's festival is Thursday night at the Jackson College Bauman Theater. Janice Blixt, welcome back to Current State.
Thank you for having me back.
Good to have you back. The usual formula being followed again with two Shakespeare works and one non-Shakespeare production. So we ought to start with the Shakespeare pieces, I suppose.
That is true. We always do one really well-known show that everyone loves. And this year we're doing As You Like It. I think people are going to absolutely go gaga over this show this year because Rob Kozlarik, who is one of our artistic associates and has directed a lot of shows for us in the past that audiences just love, he's directing it and he's got a very fairy tale view of the story, and he likes all of the characters coming together with redemption at the end, and it's he has the vision of the show that's a lot of fun and it's romantic and beautiful, and he set it in a kind of Victorian, post-industrial sort of feeling when we're in the city. And then when we move into the Forest of Arden, it's a very lush and romantic world. So I think visually it's going to be stunning and lovely. And just the show itself is going to be something that everyone is going to want to see because it's going to be fun and funny and silly and lovely.
You've hinted at one of the questions I always have whenever we talk about Shakespeare with anyone, and that is whether you're doing a traditional setting or if you're updating it. So let's talk about that at greater length here and also with regard to the second Shakespeare program on the schedule this year.
Well, I get asked that a lot. I get asked, are you doing it, period? What we do when we at the Michigan Shakespeare Festival choose when to set shows is we try to look at the show and think, what is the spine of this? What is the purpose of the show? What is our audience going to most connect with? And then it kind of comes from there, which is why As You Like It, Rob, when he was looking at this, he really liked the fairy tale aspect of it. You know, a strong heroine and there's no mother and she gets banished into the woods and she has to survive and she meets the man she loves and all of that. And he liked the very fairy tale aspect of that. So he wanted there to be sort of a fairy tale connection. And we recognize women in long dresses and corsets and all that prettiness. He liked that. Mm. So that's where he went. With Richard II, which is the second of our two Shakespeare shows, and the lesser known, this is the one that people keep coming to me and saying, oh, good, this was on my bucket list. I've never seen this one. For one of the history plays, it's kind of an oddity because it's less about events that happened historically that Shakespeare is bringing up, and it's more about the philosophies of kingship of these two guys. It's a much more philosophical show. What is the nature of kingship? How do we receive power? What gives us power? Can you give up power once you have it? All of these things. And so I didn't feel after last year's Henry IV, which we put up, which we set period, and the costumes were very appropriately late medieval, I didn't want to do that again. So Richard II is set modern dress in terms of clothing, but one of the things that gets talked about a lot in the show is the fact that Richard ascended the throne at the age of 9. From his grandfather, Edward III, who reigned for 50 years. Mm-hmm. Edward III really created the world that these characters in Richard II are living in through his actions and his family. So scenically, we've got a very Gothic look going because it was Gothic architecture that became popular under the time of Edward III. So we've got the symbols and everything on it that look very Gothic, with Gothic windows and a Gothic arch that's been kind of moved onto its side to give it a slightly modern and disconnected feel. So it's that idea again that these are people living in modern times, but they're constantly overshadowed by the past and by the history that's around them, by England itself. So that's why I went that direction with Richard II.
We're talking with Jan Blixt. Jan is producing artistic director of the Michigan Shakespeare Festival. This is the festival's 22nd year. We really need to spend some time on the non-Shakespeare play in your schedule this year, The Killer Angels. It's based on a Pulitzer Prize-winning novel by Michael Schara. You're directing this show.
Directing.
And it's a Michigan theatrical premiere for this show. Tell us about it.
It is. This is the first time that I know of that we actually have a playwright around, because we tend to work on a lot of the shows from dead guys.
Right.
So we have The Killer Angels this year, which was adapted for the stage by Karen Tarian. And Michael Schara really loved her adaptation and has given her the rights to be able to put it up in different places. Most of the other productions were in tiny little theaters. And so this is the, I believe, the first really big mounting of this show. And this is the first time we have done an adaptation. And I'm absolutely thrilled about this. If you don't know the novel, it is The Battle of Gettysburg, the 4 days of the Battle of Gettysburg. And what Karen has done with it is she has linked sequences together with the music of the time, with the songs that we all recognize. And she has created a show that very much is the generals and the decision makers and the interaction between them as they're making the decisions that lead up to Pickett's charge, which is pretty much the final huge action sequence of the show. We have 12 actors basically doing this. It is very theatricalized. Mm. We do not have horses and we don't have cannons, but it really is about these men and their views on the war and their views on each other's ability to fight the war. And when I presented this originally to the board of the Michigan Shakespeare Festival, they were excited about it. They thought it was a great idea, but then they kept saying, but how do you justify this on our mission statement? How do you connect with this? And I ended up sending them copies of the script because I said, you have to read it to understand it is a Shakespearean history. The Shakespearean histories are about the kings and the lords and the people who make the decisions that move us into the battles that happen in all of these plays. And that is very much what The Killer Angels is. It is put together in about 25 scenes. The actors are all playing multiple characters in it. We did an intense amount of research going in to make sure that the costuming would be right and to make sure that the music would be right and to make sure that all of the aspects of production would be right. And then, I don't want to say we set that aside, because we didn't, But we had to take all of that knowledge and translate it into 12 guys doing the Battle of Gettysburg. So we stripped away a lot of the really tiny specifics, and we're giving the flavor of things in the same way classical theater has done for hundreds of years. It lives on stage as a dramatic piece. It's not the movie, but in so many ways, it's so much more human than the movie. You get to know these guys, and you know what they're going through and the reason they make the decisions they make. It is an incredible piece of live American theater that I like to reference to people about how when Shakespeare was writing his history plays, the latest history play in the chronologically that he wrote was Henry VIII. We are closer to the events of the Killer Angels, but in a similar kind of time frame as Shakespeare was for Henry VIII. And the same way an Elizabethan audience could see one of Shakespeare's history plays and get the references and know the ins and outs because they grew up culturally knowing these families and knowing this history, our audience, our modern audience today, knows General Lee, knows the Battle of Gettysburg, knows Pickett's Charge, knows those things, and walks in with that automatic connection. So I'm just over the moon being able to bring this to the stage here.
I believe this is the second year where you've split your schedule up between Jackson and another theater.
Yes,
so
it is.
You open July 7th with the first preview performance of As You Like It at the Bauman Theater at Jackson College. You're there for 3 weeks, and then you spend 3 weeks at the Village Theater in Canton starting on July 29th.
Yes.
So I wanted to ask you from your perspective how that played out last year. It would appear that you were pleased with the result last year.
Because
since
we decided
you're doing
to
it again.
Do it again, right?
but look back on how that worked last year, not just for the company, but for the audiences.
Well, we were very pleased. One of the reasons that we chose the Village Theater in Canton is that the footprint of the stage, of the space, is very similar to our home theater, the Bauman in Jackson. So transferring from one space to the other is a lot easier than if we were moving into a space where everything was different. We were able to just kind of pick it up, put it in trucks, move it over, and start over, which is lovely. So there's that decision. But one of the things it did for us, which we absolutely loved, is we were able to maintain so much of our usual audience in Jackson that is coming from Jackson and is coming from Grand Rapids and Lansing, that's coming up from the Irish Hills and their vacation homes. So we were able to keep them and put up these shows in our home. And one of the things that being in Canton did for us is it pulled from St. Clair County and from further north and from further east, people who might come and see one show in Jackson but don't want to make the drive repeatedly were able to come see a show in Jackson and then see one of the other shows in Canton. And that seems to have been, based on our audience demographics, that seems to be what happened, is that we didn't lose audience in Jackson, but we had a lot of the same people seeing one show in one place and then seeing another show in another place. It's close enough that we had some people in Jackson who were saying, hey, you moved the calendar forward a week, I'm going to be in my summer place and not be able to get there. They ended up driving into Canton and seeing a show there, which was lovely, the kind of cross-pollinization that happened. We had about a 17% increase overall in ticket sales for last year. And so we're thrilled with that. So we decided to do it again.
The capacities are roughly the same?
Yes, the capacities of each houses are the same. We have a 400-seat house in both spaces, which means that all of our union requirements and things like that are fulfilled, and we don't have to worry about that. It worked great for us, and we hope to be able to continue this.
The Michigan Shakespeare Festival begins 3 weeks in Jackson at the Jackson College Bauman Theater with the first preview performance of As You Like It on July 7th. The schedule also includes Richard II and The Killer Angels. The 3 weeks in Jackson will be followed by 3 more weeks at the Village Theater in Canton. You can find complete information at MichiganShakespeareFestival.com. Janice Blixt is the festival's producing artistic director. Always good to see you. Thanks, Jan.
Thank you so much for having me. It's good to see you again.
For Current State, I'm Scott Pohl.
And coming up on Current State, our last pop-up story event at the Allen Marketplace was a great success. Our theme was putting down roots. Coming up, we'll hear storyteller Marissa Thaler talk about finding her place with a new job in Lansing. That and more after the break on Current State. I hope you managed to catch Garrison Keillor's swan song on Prairie Home Companion Saturday night on WKAR. It was a great conclusion to the show. And in Sunday's New York Times, Dwight Garner wrote that Garrison Keillor served up a lot of uncomplicated pleasure for his listeners. I enjoyed that turn of phrase, uncomplicated pleasure. 42 years of it. And Garrison Keillor is said to be working on a memoir, so apparently there's at least one more book inside of him. The radio may be gone, but the books will keep on coming, presumably. It's Current State here on WKAR. For farmers across Michigan and the country, pollination is essential for making their crops grow. For years now, growers have kept a closer eye on a key pollinator, bees, mainly because their numbers have been declining. Our next guest has spent close to 4 years focusing on alternative pollination strategies, mainly involving wild bees. Rufus Isaacs is a professor of entomology here at Michigan State University, and I believe this is your third visit to Current State, so welcome back.
Thank you, Mark. Good morning.
Let's start with some context out there for 2016 right now. Generally, how challenged are American growers as far as pollinators go?
Well, I think it depends on the grower. If you're a grower of crops that need pollination and you rent honeybees, perhaps, then you're certainly concerned about it. I think most growers in Michigan have been able to get enough honeybee colonies, and Michigan beekeepers have been able to supply them with what they need. But at the national scale, there's concern because the overall number of honeybee colonies has declined and the need for pollination is going up, with people planting more and more blueberries, apples, cherries, almonds.
Geographically, how does this break down? Where is the United States most challenged geographically?
So we've looked at this in a recent analysis across the country and have found certain areas of the country where it's much more of an issue for wild bees. That study was more looking at the other pollinators, the many other species that provide pollination. And we found areas of California in the Central Valley and also areas of the Midwest where land use is much more intense. As you might expect, those are areas where wild bee populations have a harder time persisting. And so you'd expect that farms in those areas would have a harder time getting natural pollination and would be more dependent on managed pollinators such as honeybees.
How are we doing generally here in the Midwest?
I think in the Midwest, we have a very active beekeeping community here in Michigan, and they do a great job of providing pollination service to this industry. But we do have springs where we get cool weather when the blueberries, apples, and cherries are in bloom, and then it's tough for the honeybees to be active enough to pollinate them. So we've also seen declines in wild bees in the Midwest. There's been some studies looking at bumblebees in particular, and they're a pollinator that many people recognize and love. And there have been some particularly dramatic declines in some bumblebee species. And there's a certain species, the rusty-patched bumblebee, that we haven't seen in Michigan since the 80s.
Is it important to keep wild bees part of the landscape? Is it arguable that you can become too dependent on managed honeybee colonies, for example?
Well, I think growers who have very intensive farms, large areas, they are quite dependent on honeybees because there's a lower wild bee population there. But there is a benefit of diversifying where you have both. You can go back to that situation I described earlier where the honeybees might not be so active in the early spring when it's cool. In those conditions, we have native bees that are adapted to our conditions, and they can fly when the weather is cool. And so that combined strategy, diversifying by combining honeybees with these wild bees, that's part of what we've been looking at in this project, to look at how beneficial that can be to mix your bees.
Now, you alluded to fruit crops here earlier. Are we more in need of bees in Michigan because of the fruit we grow in this state?
That's right, yeah. We have a large and diverse fruit and vegetable industry here. We mustn't forget the Michigan's number one for pickling cucumbers, and they need honeybees and other bees to visit those flowers. And we also have, as many people know, the large fruit crop acres as well. And so, yes, that makes us more dependent. So in the springtime, when the weather starts to warm up, we get thousands of colonies of honeybees that come up from their overwintering conditions down in Florida, Georgia, and Texas, and come up into Michigan to pollinate those crops. So they're migratory beekeepers bringing colonies as well as the colonies that stay here through the winter in Michigan.
We will get to the particulars of some of your recent work here in just a moment here. We're talking with Rufus Isaacs, an entomologist here at Michigan State University. Rufus has been studying pollination options for growers involving both wild bees and human-managed honeybees as well. Talk to us again here. 2016, where do we stand? People have been hearing for years mm-hmm. that the bee population has been going down. What do we know about the factors that have led to that drop in bee populations?
Yeah, so first of all, it's worth mentioning that there have been surveys done by the USDA and other organizations that they support, and there has been a little bit of an increase in the number of honeybee colonies compared to the long-term trend of decline. So that's encouraging. It's not a big increase, but it's at least showing that the decline might have slowed. And then in terms of factors, the three most important that are I think, well understood as key factors driving bee decline are habitat loss, pesticide, and also the pathogens, the diseases and the parasites that affect bees. So depending on the bee, one or more of those might be more important, but the interaction between those seems to be what a lot of people are suggesting is what's driving this. So you might imagine a bee that's in a landscape that doesn't have too many flowers to visit might mm-hmm. be more susceptible to the stress of diseases it might pick up or pesticides it might be exposed to, and vice versa. Those factors are all interacting to weaken bees.
The phrase colony collapse disorder came into circulation here a few years back. Is that still an issue?
I think colony collapse disorder really focused people's attention on what was going on with the concerns with bees. But now we see more of a focus on bee health broadly. Yes, there are colonies that show those symptoms, but that's a very specific set of symptoms, and there are broader issues going on with bee health. So, yeah, I think colony collapse is something that people are concerned about, but we've now turned attention, I think, to bee nutrition, bee disease control. There are mites that are affecting honeybees that are causing beekeepers a lot of headaches. So the broad suite of practices that need to be used to keep bees healthy is what is being focused on there.
Well, overall then, though, is the United States still on a worrisome trajectory here regarding bee populations?
Well, there's certainly national concern about this. I don't think people have stopped being concerned. It's definitely something that's received national attention now. We have a White House memorandum that was released by the government a year or more ago, and that's driven now a lot of investment that's coming to research and extension and education about bee health issues. So I actually see more activity now around the country on pollinator issues. There's a conference coming up in 2 weeks that we're going to in Pennsylvania, and 500 people are coming together to talk about issues affecting bees. So I think the concern is still there. There's signs for optimism, though. I think people are seeing that there's attention to this issue, and also more planting habitat for pollinators, more attention to pesticide issues, more attention to disease management.
How do we beef that wild bee population up, though?
Well, wild bees don't have beekeepers the same way that a honeybee does. So the key to that is creating places for them to persist. And they need two key things. They need a place to nest, and they need flowers to visit to get their pollen and nectar, which is the protein and the carbohydrate that they need. So there's a national target of creating 7 million acres of habitat for pollinators. And part of that memorandum that I mentioned just now from the federal government is targeting that goal. We're trying to do our part for that in Michigan, and there's a lot of agencies coupled, partnering with MSU and other groups around the state to try and increase pollinator habitat out in farmland and in natural areas. And all of those efforts, we hope, will build the capacity of Michigan and other states to support wild bees.
I take it you're wrapping up, or you're approaching, at the very least, approaching the conclusion of a four-year or so work involving these alternative pollinator strategies. Talk to us a little bit more about some of the things that you found.
Okay, yeah. So this has been a national project, and I'd like to focus in a little bit today on talking about one of the Michigan examples, where we've been able to go into almost 20 Michigan blueberry farms and look at how important honeybees and wild bees are in those settings, and what kind of benefit the growers are getting from those pollinators. So in these larger commercial farms, we find that honeybees are the dominant pollinator. These colonies are brought there by the grower in the spring, or contracted by the grower with the beekeeper to get them there in the spring. Mm-hmm. And here we found that naturally pollination of blueberry is quite good. We do find wild bees in those fields. We find more of them in farms where there's more wild area nearby. So if a grower has either a woodland next to the farm, or they have a little patch of one of these pollinator plantings that may have been put in there, then they get more wild bees, and that translates then into greater yield at harvest time. So this time of the year, when people are in the store buying their blueberries or their cherries, think about the bees that were doing that work back in the spring.
So it sounds like there's a land use dynamic that's in play here as well. Are you advocating more wild spaces? You alluded to the creation of more habitat.
So we've seen benefit of that in terms of greater yield and also greater profit for the farmer in the blueberry studies that we've done. We do see a great benefit of that for bees. There's also some benefits for natural enemies that attack pest insects. And also, you can think about associated benefits for nutrient runoff and other aspects that habitat may create in farms. The federal government now is supporting these programs by investing in programs here in Michigan that, through the Natural Resource Conservation Service, farmers can sign up for this. And there are some requirements that you have to, some hoops that you have to jump through to do it, but a lot of the cost of this can be borne by others other than the grower at the beginning to get this set up. So that can be a program that could then help meet these goals of greater habitat around the state and support the national goals.
Rufus Isaacs is an entomologist here at Michigan State University. He's been studying pollination options for growers involving both wild bees and human-managed honeybees. It sounds as if the honeybee business might not be a bad business to get into here in recent years.
Well, it's been challenging. I think there's been a lot of challenges for beekeepers, but there is certainly demand. And a beekeeper who rents their colony here in Michigan to a grower could get a certain amount of money for that, but it could be three or four times that if they go to pollinate almonds in California. So there's definitely a supply and demand here, and as the demand goes up, the rental costs go up as well. Mm. So we even see Michigan beekeepers taking their colonies to California to support that important industry out there.
I know there are various pollinator initiatives. There is the Michigan Pollinator Initiative, and MSU is part of a pollinator protection plan. Talk to us a little bit about those.
So the first of those, the Michigan Pollinator Initiative, is an effort by MSU funded through the College of Agriculture and Natural Resources to just bring together the people at MSU that are already working on pollinators. We have a number of faculty around campus, and then their staff in their labs, students and postdocs. And so we've been meeting regularly and trying to think about how we can bring together the expertise of MSU to help the various issues related to pollination. So it's bees, but it's also monarch butterflies, thinking broadly about pollinator issues here in the state. So that just has been going for just over a year, and doing a lot of good work for beekeepers and other groups interested in pollination. And then that Managed Pollinator Protection Plan that you mentioned is an effort at the state level to tie into a national program to improve the health of pollinators in general, but honeybees specifically, by addressing some of the risks that they face when they're out in agricultural landscapes or other landscapes. So we're bringing together there the Department of Agriculture, Michigan State University, Farm Bureau. There's some other groups involved that are meeting regularly and putting that together. We had one big meeting in the spring where 50 stakeholders came together and discussed their issues and challenges and what they'd like to see in this plan. And then there's listening sessions through the summer and fall, and we expect to have the actual plan together by the first of the year next year.
Just a very important reminder to the extent to which we depend on bees and other pollinators, wild and otherwise. We want to thank our guest, Rufus Isaacs, an entomologist here at Michigan State University. He has been studying, focusing on pollination options for growers involving both wild bees and human-managed honeybees. Rufus, good to see you. Thank you.
Thank you, Mark.
Time now for another Current State pop-up story. Our last storytelling outing was at the Allen Marketplace. The theme was putting down roots. Here's Marissa Thaler telling her story about finding her place with a new job in Lansing.
So earlier this year, we adopted a dog and we named him Ollie for Oliver Twist. When he showed up at our house, he was sick and so sad, but we took him to the vet and gave him lots of love and food, and he has made a full recovery and is now a very energetic and spastic pain in the butt. And turns out he's still a puppy, yay. So we've got a lot of things that we're dealing with, like chewing and digging. Earlier this summer, he smelled a mole and dug up half our front lawn to find the thing. And we ended up using like this huge bag of dirt and 3/4 a bag of grass seed just to make it not look like a construction zone. And it's funny to me because I never really pictured us owning a dog, and not because we're not dog people, but because we're busy people. When we moved down to Lansing area about 8 years ago, I had just gotten my art education degree and I was looking for a job. There was nothing. So in the meantime, I was subbing. And if you've never subbed before, it's terrible. It's the worst thing ever. And you just kind of put your head down and try and get through the day and then go home and maybe drink some wine and cry a little, and then you do the same thing the next day. So I don't recommend it, but it was a good way to pass the time. And I kind of attribute that to not really feeling like I belonged in Lansing for quite a while. I had never really struggled to make friends or to feel at home. So here I was in a new city with these new struggles, and it totally knocked me off my feet. So 2 years of subbing go by, and I finally get a long-term sub job, and it's perfect. It's in a good district. It's close to home. It's high school, which is great. And best yet, somebody's retiring, which means they're going to post the job. And I thought, if I can just get in and do a really good job, they'll hire me, and then I'll fit in someplace. So I go in, and guys, I'm killing it. I mean, I wrote the best curriculum I've ever written. I'm connecting with these kids. And it was such a good job that I was willing to kind of ignore certain things. Like my CT was really tough to like get along with. And that's my cooperating teacher, by the way. The staff wasn't super friendly. The guidance counselor pulled me into her office and told me to dumb down my curriculum because here in this district, we feel that art should be an easy break from our more challenging core classes. No, I know, which I totally disagreed with, but I was like, I just want to fit in, so I'll just ignore it, right? So they post the job, and I apply for it, and I kill the interview, and when I'm walking out, the principal shakes my hand. He says, Marissa, we'll call you. And they did. A week later, and they gave it to somebody else. And it broke me. And I thought, what's wrong with you that you can't get a job you're already doing? Why can't you just fit in? And the worst part was, I still had 2 weeks to finish out in this long-term sub job. It was terrible, and everybody was really nice. They said, oh, well, you didn't get it because, you know, your dream job must be right around the corner, and you need to be open for that one, and it's gonna be great. And I was like, yeah, okay. And it didn't come. My dream job wasn't the next job I took. I continued subbing for another year, and then I took another long-term sub job. And in that job, I met my first Lansing friend. And she encouraged me to be brave and tap into different people and things in the area. And now, 5 years later, not only do I have a full-time teaching job, but I'm part of a book club, a dinner party club, a volleyball league, a soccer team, a gallery, a studio, and there are places that I feel at home. So our dog, Ollie, bless his heart, he found that that fourth of a bag of grass seed that was left over. And he proceeded to take it down and empty it into my meticulously weeded flower bed. And I was like, ah! So I'm on my knees and I'm pulling handfuls of this really beautiful, healthy grass that has grown up and choked out my daisies. And I'm just ripping this out. And I thought, you know, it's not the grass's fault that it was ready to grow. It was just in the wrong spot. Thank you.
Storyteller Marissa Thaler there. Join us for our next Pop-Up Stories event, July 29th, Valley Court Park, East Lansing. Call of the Wild is the theme. It's current state. We're back tomorrow. We hope you are too. 90.5 WKAR.